Hello, Absurdistanis, and welcome to Absurdistan, the transatlantic political podcast with news and opinion from the absurd political reality which is our home. My name is Adam.
And my name is John.
Today we take a look at the controversial Nazi pug free speech case in Scotland, Finland's decision to stop trials of universal basic income, and John will review the gerrymandering cases before the Supreme Court. We will also be filling you in on some of the details that you should be keeping an eye on this week. But first, John, how are you?
I'm doing well, Adam. Thanks for asking. We're finally getting a little bit of spring weather here in New England, so I've been spending some time out with the kids and it's been great. How about you?
I have been thoroughly enjoying today. It's been an odd day in Spanish politics in which the mayor of Madrid was found on video stealing anti-aging creams out of a supermarket. So politics just gets weirder and weirder.
Oh, that's awesome.
Anyway, amusingly, John, understand that you're actually starting with a story from my own country, in Scotland.
Yeah, that's right. I normally would have a story from the US for you, but I just couldn't pass this one up. It's right in my wheelhouse. It's something I'm really passionate about. Marcus Meacham, he's a 30-year-old amateur YouTube comedian from Scotland, was sentenced on Monday for being grossly offensive. That's right. He was convicted for being grossly offensive. This was him talking to a Sky News reporter after his sentencing on Monday.
What's funny about that?
The context of it is the juxtaposition of having an adorable animal react to something vulgar. That was the entire point of the joke. Have you seen the video?
Do you accept you committed a crime?
Have you seen the video?
I have.
Right, okay, so I explained the context in it, so why are you asking me again?
Well, the context is that you've been fined £800 for a crime that you committed.
We're talking about the context of the video.
We had in court.
Yeah, can I just ask? Why
we had in court that you committed gross offence against a large community of 6 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust.
You just said the statement a couple of seconds ago. Why should I consider your context if you're not concerning mine?
You've broken the law. Do you regret breaking the law?
You just broke the law 2 seconds ago when you said the phrase. Remember, context matters, mate.
To give you some background on the case, Meacham is known on the internet as Count Dankula, and he posted a video on his YouTube channel titled Mate, Your Doug's a Nazi in April of 2016. The video starts with Meacham giving basically a disclaimer. He says that his girlfriend thought her pug, Buddha, was so cute and it was really annoying to him, so he decided to turn the pug into the least cute thing he could think of, which was a Nazi. As you can imagine, a video of this nature is controversial. He says, "Gas the Jews," 23 times throughout the video. Now, the context here is important. When he says, "Gas the Jews," essentially what that is him asking the dog to go out on a walk. The dog perks up, gets excited, gets ready like it's about to go out and have some fun. So he's trained the dog to respond to that phrase that way. There's a scene in the video where the dog is seen watching Hitler's Nuremberg speeches intensely. He's up on the desk just staring at the screen. And there's also a section where Meacham repeatedly says the phrase Sieg Heil, to which the dog has been trained to raise its paw as if it's Hitler saluting. And originally, Meacham said that the video was only supposed to be seen by friends. He didn't have a very large following on YouTube prior to this. But a viewer shared the video, I believe, to Reddit, and it just exploded. It became viral, and it was viewed almost a million times. So this video actually caught the attention of the Scottish police, and Meacham was arrested on April 28th, 2016, charged under the Communications Act of 2003. And this act made malicious online communications a criminal offence.
That's right. It's illegal to be obscene in Scotland, which strikes me as so funny knowing the culture, because there are certain subcultures, for instance, in Scotland, in which the use of the C word to refer to friends or to use in casual speech is perfectly acceptable. The same with the F word. I think Scottish humour, and particularly its language, has a certain obscenity and acceptance of that obscenity that doesn't exist in other parts of the UK or in other parts of the English-speaking world, except perhaps Australia. And I really sympathise with this guy because he's from Lanarkshire. He's from a town called Coatbridge, which is just a few miles away from my hometown, Wishaw, which is also in Lanarkshire. So I know the culture that he's coming out of. Lanarkshire's a rough place. It tends to have that working class roughness around its edges, and that includes its language, as well as its sense of humour. And so whether you think the content of this video is good or not, I think it's important to recognise the context of, and particularly the Lanarkshire context of this guy. So I wouldn't say I'm necessarily defending Meachin at this point, but he's from my neck of the woods. I understand essentially where he's coming from. I don't necessarily have a sympathy for the sense of humour, but I think the cultural context is important as well. And it's also important to note that the Scottish courts are particularly conservative. In Scotland, there are certain judicial practices that have been held over for centuries that should probably be reformed. So the system itself tends to have a morally conservative bias, let's say.
The trial took 2 years to finally happen. It kept getting pushed out and pushed out. And then earlier this year, the prosecution actually pushed to go from a 1 year sentence and actually push for a 5 year sentence. So they actually wanted to increase the punishment for the crime. The judge ultimately decided against it. And then the trial was held in March 2018. And so he was convicted. He was convicted under this act as being grossly offensive. Now, his defense was essentially saying that it's really important to consider the context of the video. Yes, he did say gas the Jews, but it was clearly in the context of a joke that he was trying to make. He was trying to juxtapose the cuteness of this dog with the horrors of Nazi ideology. And literally, he made the video to annoy his girlfriend. But the court didn't agree with his argument. They said that it wasn't up to him to decide the context. It was up to the court to decide the context, which I think is a terrible precedent to set when you have a court system, a government deciding the context of jokes and deciding whether or not you're going to be convicted of a crime merely because the judge in question doesn't have your sense of humor or doesn't understand the joke.
One of the most important aspects of this case, and we've already heard it in the Sky News interview, is context. Of course, context is inextricably linked to intent. And intent is the foundational basis on which judgments are handed down. Even if, you know, someone has on paper broken the law and they're shown not to have had the intent, that leads to a significantly different sentence and a significantly different judgment.
Oh, definitely. I mean, even if you think in terms of the difference between murder and manslaughter, it's all about intent. The end result is still the same. Somebody died. But if the intent it was for that person to die from the outset, then it's murder, and if not, it's manslaughter.
But at the same time, it is up to the judicial system ultimately to determine intent. Is that correct?
Correct.
So then why is it an issue here in Count Dankula's case that the court is deciding what the intent was? Because, like, as you said, it's the difference between murder and manslaughter. Why can't it play a role here?
I think the big difference for me is that there's a clear victim in the case of a murder versus manslaughter case, and it's important to charge the person with the crime and convict them. I'm from the United States. The idea that you could be charged and convicted for telling a joke is completely out of the realm of anything that's considerable for me. We have, in the United States at least, a constitutional protection for free speech. Now, there are some guidelines there. You can't do slander or libel. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. You can't make direct threats of violence or incite violence on someone else. Those are limits that are put on free speech by our court system. But ultimately, something like this would never merit a court case, a charge. You would never be arrested for making a joke like this. I mean, for goodness sakes, just a couple months ago, we had Nazis marching in Charlottesville. And the ones who were peacefully protesting, who weren't breaking things or committing a physical offense, the ones who were shouting blood and soil and the Jews will not replace us, were not charged. That was protected under the umbrella of free speech. So it's so foreign to me, no pun intended, that a budding amateur comedian who tells what some would consider to be a tasteless joke is now potentially facing prison time. And you're actually setting up a precedent, which we'll get to shortly. You're going to have people self-censoring themselves along the lines of what the state finds to be acceptable discourse. And I think that's a monumental breach of human rights.
I think one of the important things to point out, though, is that, you know, in Scotland, you still have free speech. You still have free speech rights. every country with free speech laws decides themselves where those red lines should be. So in Germany, for instance, you definitely can't evoke Nazism. You can't advocate for Nazism. That is against the law. And different countries will do it for different reasons. What has to be remembered is that the UK, including Scotland, doesn't have a liberal history. If anything, it actually has a conservative history. And I don't mean that in terms of the left-right dynamic that's in the States. America has, for the entirety of its history, valued first the individual and their right to free speech. The UK, for most of its history, has always had a conservative tendency to want to retain the structures of the society that have pre-existed the present time.
One of the big differences that we have also is that the United States is built upon a constitution, whereas the UK isn't. The UK is more built on common law that's developed through the court system, and we do have specific enumerated constitutional rights for individuals in the States, and actually restrictions on government in the United States, where you don't have the same sort of dynamic in Britain. And so rather than having fundamental rights that need to be protected at all costs, you have sort of a balancing of rights, let's call them, in the UK. So your right to free speech must be balanced against somebody's right not to be offended, or society as a whole's right to not be offended. And I would argue, as a liberal, as an American, that there is no right to not be offended. I just don't believe there's such a thing. I think that's a fundamental limit on free speech, and it's a limit on thought even. And this is actually, I think, one of the reasons why we're seeing a resurgence of right-wing thinkers like Jordan Peterson, for instance, who's become massively popular lately with mostly young people, young conservatives who are coming into this next generation who want free speech, want freedom of thought, don't want to be told how they can talk and what they can think and what's acceptable in society. And he was on Bill Maher the other day talking about how in order to think, you really have to be offensive. You have to risk offending somebody to actually have a true discussion about anything. If you're only worried about political correctness, then you're not going to be able to get very far. Because most of the time when you're trying to find truth, when you're engaged in dialectic, you're going to bring some very uncomfortable things to the surface, and you're not going to grow or learn anything without the freedom to potentially be offensive. And so you're seeing this, and this is what I fear out of the situation, is that the traditional left, who have always fought for these sorts of things, now are almost developing, and even in the United States, you see this a little bit, they're developing an ideology that accepts the idea there is a right not to be offended, and that it can trump other rights, such as free speech. And I think that's a hell of a way to lose younger people, to lose people who otherwise might agree with you on policy, but can't agree with you that you're going to be advocating to not necessarily take away their individual rights, but limit them in a way that just almost seems Orwellian, I guess.
One thing I'd like to get your opinion on is the response of the Jewish community in Scotland. So they actually had a Scottish Jewish leader testifying at the Airdrie Sheriff Court, and he said, "It stuns me that anyone should think that's a joke. My immediate reaction is that there is a clear distinction to be made between an offhand remark and the amount of effort that's required to train a dog like that. I actually feel sorry for the dog," he says. He labels the video a threat, and he says specifically that the threat is against the Jewish community and there's an echo chamber effect with people trying to be more offensive. So I was wondering what you thought. Do the Jewish advocacy groups have a point here? Do they have a legitimate say in a court case like this?
They are absolutely entitled to their opinion, but I don't think that it should influence legal precedent. The thing that I'm seeing, and this isn't just limited to this case we're discussing now, there was another case that happened recently where a young lady by the name of Chelsea Russell, her friend died in a car accident, and she posted rap lyrics on her Instagram, and these rap lyrics contained a specific racial slur. And somebody, one person, saw this on her Instagram and literally went to the police and filed a complaint under this same act, this Communications Act of 2003 that Count Dankula was convicted and sentenced under. She was convicted on the testimony of this one person saying that they were offended. She was sentenced to 8 weeks community service, 8 weeks curfew, and she was ordered by law to pay £500 as a fine and then an £85 victim surcharge, which to me, as a classical liberal thinker, who is the victim here? There is no victim of you posting some lyrics on Instagram. At some point, you need to take responsibility, and I'm sounding like a conservative, but you have to take responsibility for your own reactions to what people say. You can't stop somebody from saying something just because it makes you moderately uncomfortable. If your physical safety was threatened, or if they were inciting violence against you or slandering you, you are well within your rights to contest that. But these lyrics were not targeted towards this person. They just happened to see them. Something that you might actually hear on the radio. A song that might come on the radio and you would hear it. What's the difference between that and somebody posting on Instagram, and why should that person then be punished for it and suffer the consequences? There shouldn't even be consequences in that case. And so while you still have free speech in Scotland, you're seeing certain strictures that are coming around it that are funneling people towards a very sanitized public discourse. Just, it's a very specific ideological framework that in which you're trying to force people. So ultimately, Count Dankula was fined £800. He didn't get jail time. But one of the things that aggravated me the most about this case was that in the sentencing hearing, the judge, when he was talking to Meechan about how he came to his decision, he said, quote, "The social work report on you is important. It is very favorable to you, and leaving aside the circumstances of this offense shows you to have led a generally pro-social life thus far. It also shows that you have learned a certain amount from your experiences and that you are of low risk of reoffending." So for people who are listening closely, he ignored the context when it came to whether or not that was a joke, but considered the context when he was going to sentence him. So in the greater context of his life, this is a small offense that doesn't merit jail time. In the context of that video, that joke merited a conviction and a sentencing. It just seems rather inconsistent. And just as a final thought here, as my opinion, I think it's ridiculous to use the phrase low risk of reoffending when you're talking about a person telling an offensive joke. As if here's a slap on the wrist, but if you tell another joke, then maybe you'll go to prison next time. It's regardless of the context, this should not have been a criminal offense. This should not have led to a conviction or a sentencing. I really don't think so. I think that once you start down that path, it's hard to come back from that sort of precedent. And what I don't think a lot of people realize is that right now the jokes that are offensive are about gassing Jews and Nazis. Politics has a funny way of going back and forth. So someday there's going to be a lot of conservatives in charge or a lot of people in charge who don't agree with you ideologically. And if you're okay with putting people away for saying things that you find offensive, then you're opening yourself up to the same sort of danger. And I think that in the interest of free speech, and I would consider myself a free speech absolutist, this sort of thing has to be fought against. He's going to appeal it. I hope it gets overturned. And I hope that more members of parliament come out against something like this, because it's something that I honestly think it's something that needs to be reconsidered. Grossly offensive is just far too subjective of a standard to set for possibly putting somebody in prison over words.
So, John, I know that we have both had interest in universal basic income. In fact, I think most people have, particularly on the left, considered universal basic income to be something that we need to figure out whether it works, because the idea sounds really good. In January of 2017, Finland launched a basic income trial. It's to last 2 years, and it took 2,000 randomly selected unemployed citizens and gave them €560 or $690 a month. Now, this money has no strings attached. It's tax-free. They get that into their account through the welfare system in Finland, which is an organization called Kela. Kela is a government agency that runs all of the benefits that you would get in Finland and has been running this research for the past year and 4 months. But this week, Finland announced that it would be ending the trial by refusing a request to extend the project into 2019. So, John, do you like the idea of universal basic income?
philosophically, yes, I would agree with it. I think that it's going to become inevitable at some point. Our technology is advancing at such a rapid rate that eventually jobs that require a human being are no longer going to require a human being. And then if you don't have some sort of safety net set up for those individuals who are not going to be able to find work, who won't have marketable skills, then you're going to have a very dangerous situation. It could lead to, you know, a breakdown of parts of society. You're seeing the effects of what happens when people's standard of living goes down drastically, like in Venezuela. Everything is just, it's a mess down there. And so to think that we're above that in the West or more developed countries, I just don't think that's the case.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned tech, because some of the biggest proponents are your Elon Musk types. He would argue for the universal basic income, largely for the exact reasons that you said. Increased automation means less work, and someone's going to have to keep people from starving, essentially. So obviously the pros of the universal basic income is that it gives that security and increases flexibility of work. It frees people up to pursue extra training if, as you say, in the case of losing their job due to automation or other things or economic downturn or whatever. To me, it actually opens a really interesting question. What would people do if they actually had the freedom to do it? Say you're working for GM and you know that your job's about to get automated and you're going to be at work. If you had the option to choose anything, like, what would you choose to do? Like, instead of fretting about income or fretting about retraining to enter the workforce, like, would you pursue art? Would you pursue charitable work? There's a litany of things that you could pursue other than even retraining for the market. That could increase quality of life. Like, so there's really interesting aspects of this that I think are undersold, perhaps underestimated. Universal basic income may also pressure employers to offer worthwhile employment, increasing job satisfaction. And it also keeps people participating in the market, whether they're employed or unemployed. More money spent is more jobs created, is more taxable income, etc., etc., etc. If you could kickstart that wheel, then, you know, perhaps you would have a self-generating economy.
Well, there's a concept in the United States that gets thrown around a lot called middle-out growth, where the idea is that rather than giving tax breaks to people who make more money, give tax breaks to people who make less money, who are more likely to reinvest that in the economy rather than stow it away in savings or investments and things like that. It's not necessarily been a proven hypothesis, but it does make a lot of sense, because when you have somebody who has a broken down car and needs to buy groceries every week, or that family being able to afford to buy another car, to be able to buy a little bit more groceries, and having more families be able to do that, rather than the ability of one person to buy three private jets, that's going to stimulate the economy more. The larger amount of people buying from the smaller companies, the mom and pop stores, that's going to be what really actually drives job creation. And so it would really, I think, be very interesting to see the effects of something like a universal basic income, where, you know, somebody like me, who was out of work for a while, still being able to spend, still being able to have experiences, increase my quality of life, but also be a productive member of society contributing to the economy.
So the logic in it is actually quite positive on a few fronts, but there are some cons as well. The biggest one, obviously, being in any social welfare system is who pays for it. And in particular, where does the cash infusion come from that actually kickstarts the system, and what if it fails? So these are obviously, it's a big risk to completely redevelop your welfare system into something that you're not entirely sure yet whether the concept works, even though the logic is sound. Does the concept actually work? And so that is where trials come in. So enter Finland. Finland is the first European country to trial a universal basic income, and is one of the largest government-run basic income trials to date, which is fascinating. A couple years ago when it was announced, Finland was hailed as the cutting-edge country that everyone should follow simply for trialing this concept. And Finland had good reason to. It actually has a higher than expected unemployment rate at 8.5% now, and it was actually 9.2% when the study started. These numbers are higher, quite a bit higher than some of its other Nordic neighbours. And the thinking is that Finland's expansive and rather complex welfare system is actually disincentivized work. So people who are out of work on benefits, if they were to take on temporary work or something that would increase their income by just a little, they could lose significant amounts of benefits. And the complexities of it meant that there was no easy way to figure out whether you would actually benefit by going back to work, so people never took the risk. Finland then thought, well, could basic income solve both the administratively complex system and raise employment simultaneously? So, are you ready for the results, John?
Yeah.
We won't know until 2019. One, because the study hasn't actually finished yet. The Finnish government has announced that it will be finishing at the end of the year. And two, it's an academic study, so discussion has to happen and research papers need to be filed and all the good stuff that goes in with academics. So we won't actually know for another couple years, it looks like. So why is Finland giving up? Well, one possible reason is an OECD report that was released in February of this year, which took a look at Finland and its economic health and particularly its benefit system. And the report found that Finnish tax would have to increase by 30% in order to support universal basic income. And that's no small amount in a Scandinavian country that's already charging significant income tax on its population. It would also raise Finland's poverty rate from 11.4% to 14.1%. And it argued that actually a universal credit system that took all of the complex benefits and just rolled it into one monthly payment would actually cut poverty down to 9.7% and would be far better than a universal basic income structure. So why is this the case? I've looked at the report myself. It's rather dense. You have to have a fairly good technical knowledge. It's based on models of current and expected outcomes over the next number of years. So if you want to see more of that detail as to where these numbers come from, 14.1%, 9.7% poverty rate, take a look at that report. We'll link it in the description. So possibly on the basis of this report, the Finnish government have decided to stop the trial. The Finnish government has also been weighing up other welfare reforms as well, and they are considering the universal credit model that's currently in place in the United Kingdom or is currently rolling out in the UK. And then finally, another possible and the likeliest reason is that there is a Finnish election in April of 2019, just a few months after the end of this trial. The perception of handling taxpayer money, and this would be to the tune of another 70 million euros over 2019 and 2020, the perception of handing taxpayer money out to jobless people is just not a politically persuasive perception to have, even in the Scandinavian countries where they are motivated, like anyone else, politically to minimise tax. In fact, the Finnish government recently, which tends to be in the centre-right, has reversed tack and has started adopting laws which threaten benefits for people who aren't actively looking for work and file a report every 3 months as to their progress in looking for work. So, if I was to give my opinion on this, having worked in a food bank charity, a system like this is never black and white. There's always going to be people who fall through the cracks, and from my perspective, end up at food banks. There were plenty of cases that we dealt with that meant that people who could legitimately not work weren't acceptable candidates for welfare benefits and ended up losing them simply because they were deemed to be healthy enough to work when in actual fact they weren't. So I'm not keen in the direction that the Finnish government is taking now, and I would hope that they would consider a move back out towards the universal ideas, either of credit or basic income. To finish up, the researchers Olli Kangas and Miska Simonainen argue that 2 years of data is not enough, and it limits the study to cut it off at 2019. They also argue that it only fills in half the picture if we're just looking at unemployed people. The system is supposed to work when employed people are also receiving a certain amount of basic income. They wanted the extra 70 million euros to help fund the second half of the project. But by the end of this year, it looks like the trial will end. There are other universal basic income trials that are underway in Ontario and the Netherlands and even in Kenya. But we look forward to seeing the results from Finland and these other places as well. I don't know, John. It's one of these things that the logic seems so good, but perhaps in practice it isn't as rosy a picture as we think because of that initial startup cost. The risk on the other side, instead of motivating people into employment, is to motivate people to rely on that basic income and not actually pursue anything greater as well. So it could actually have a negative effect on the economy. Like, it's such a tough thing to do, and I guess that's why trials like this are important.
Well, speaking from the United States, there's generally a negative attitude towards welfare as a thing, as something that the government is responsible for. This actually even comes down to an ideological debate, really, in the United States, which is, what is the state responsible for? And really, I think that's probably the best way that you can categorize people in the United States, because honestly, the terms liberal and conservatives are coming to mean very little. But the biggest divisions that you see in the United States are whether or not the state should have an increased role in the provision of people's income and health insurance and services. So something that's been kicked around in the United States is the idea of a negative tax, a negative income tax. Instead of paying tax, you would actually receive extra money in your paycheck from the government just to supplement your income. So that's been floated as an alternative to universal basic income that might not be quite as expensive, because it does put those limits where you're always going to have perverse incentives in a system like this, where if you say if you make under a certain amount, then you're eligible for this, then the incentive on you is to not make over the maximum amount allowed because you want to remain on your benefits. If we can figure out a way to circumvent those perverse incentives, I think you could make it work. You could have a requirement for work, a requirement that you need to be, if you are able-bodied, seeking work full-time and be more.
That's what Finland has just now. That's what they've introduced. And it's that I have an issue with, because how can the government determine what is able-bodied? Because it didn't work in the UK. A significant number of our clients at the food banks ended up being folk that were deemed eligible to work who clearly weren't, either because of mental or physical disabilities.
And that's very true. I did some volunteering at a homeless shelter where I was talking with a guy who had a master's degree in biochemistry. And from what I could tell, that was true. A lot of times homeless people can exaggerate their stories. Many of them have mental health issues. But from what I could tell, speaking with this man, he knew an incredible amount about biochemistry. So whether or not he actually had his degree or not, he still definitely had the intelligence of somebody who could be a productive member of society and have a job, but he was unemployed because of layoffs or what have you, and he was in a homeless shelter. So you definitely do have cases where people are skilled, they're able to work, and they just fall through the cracks in the system. And like you said, unfortunately, that's always going to happen. It'll be interesting to see what the ultimate end point is of the test that's going on in Ontario. I know it's a little bit different than the Finland system. They're actually expanding it to 4,000 people, and they're mixing it in with people who are unemployed and employed. If you make less than 34,000 Canadian dollars, which is like $26,000 American, if you're making less than that, then you are eligible for the program. So you're going to see a UBI system that supplements income as well. Maybe that will work better. It might be a little bit less expensive. This is why I think that the best idea is to levy the taxes that are going to be needed to raise the income for this on the labor produced by anything that's taking human labor away. That might even be enough to disincentivize people from switching to robot labor. It might not. In the end, you'd still have a way to pay for it without overburdening the other members of society.
In this week's report, John reviews some of the gerrymandering cases that are before the Supreme Court. Decisions made here will have huge effects on future elections.
We'll hear argument first this morning in case 16-1161, Gill versus Whitford. Mr. Saitlin?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this Court has never uncovered judicially manageable standards for determining when politicians have acted too politically in drawing district lines.
The Supreme Court has long been among the most politically divisive institutions in the United States, and with good reason. Over the years, the Court has handed down landmark rulings that have not only provided interpretation of the Constitution, but also challenged societal norms in a profound way. Among these are Brown v. Board of Education, which ended segregation in schools, Roe v. Wade, which legalized abortion, Obergefell v. Hodges, which recognized the right of same-sex couples to marry, and even Citizens United v. FEC, which removed some restrictions on political donations made by corporations. Whether you consider yourself a liberal or a conservative or really anywhere in between, you've likely disagreed with a Supreme Court decision at some point. This term, the court is deciding two such politically divisive cases. In America, the voting districts within individual states are drawn by the incumbent elected representatives using the latest census data. As one might imagine, this can result in highly partisan redistricting, also known as gerrymandering, where the districts are drawn with the express purpose of concentrating the voters for the opposition party into as few districts as possible. This has been done throughout the years to devastating effect. Advances in technology have allowed those drawing the maps to quite literally carve out districts street by street and in some cases house by house. What all this means is that although a state may have a more even distribution of voters from all political stripes, those in the minority can have their votes diluted even further. In front of the court are two cases, Gill v. Whitford and Benisek v. Lamone, both of which challenged the constitutionality of gerrymandering. In 1986, the court ruled in Davis v. Bandemir that partisan redistricting is a constitutional issue that can be decided by the Supreme Court. In 2004, in Veith v. Jubilier, the court upheld a district court ruling that partisan gerrymandering was not unconstitutional, but the court did not go so far as overturning Davis v. Bandemir. The decision written by Anthony Scalia noted that there was no discernible and manageable standard for, quote, adjudicating political gerrymandering claims. Notably, however, Stephen Breyer, in his concurring opinion with the Veith decision, wrote that in the future, a standard could be determined by the court to adjudicate these claims. In 2006, with League of United Latin American Citizens v. Perry, the Supreme Court held that Texas's District 23, as drawn in the 2003 redistricting, violated the Voting Rights Act of 1965, but the court still refused to overturn the entire map, noting that the plaintiffs did not have a sufficient claim of partisan gerrymandering. This resulted in a partial redraw of the district maps, though the Republican seats gained by this redistricting were retained. Thus far, the court has refused to take a strong stance on partisan redistricting, citing the lack of a meaningful standard to decide the constitutionality of individual districts. But this could change. In October of 2017, the court heard oral arguments for Gill v. Whitford. In 2011, Republicans in Wisconsin redrew the state assembly districts in an attempt to gain control of the state legislatures. The district map that resulted was so skewed in favor of Republicans that a political science professor who assisted in drawing the maps claimed that, quote, Republicans would maintain a majority under any likely voting scenario. This new map was so effective that despite Republicans only receiving 48.6% of the statewide vote, they gained 60.6% of the seats in the state assembly in the 2012 elections. In July 2015, the Campaign Legal Center, led by Professor William Whitford, filed suit claiming that the district maps drawn by the Wisconsin Assembly violated the 14th Amendment's guarantee of equal protection under the law. In 2016, a federal panel of three judges declared that the map was unconstitutional by a vote of 2-1. What is interesting about this case is that the panel introduced a three-pronged test to determine whether or not partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional. The test asks if the redistricting was 1, intended to place a severe impediment on the effectiveness of the votes of individual citizens on the basis of their political affiliation, 2, if the redistricting has that effect, and 3, if the redistricting cannot be justified on other legitimate legislative grounds. The panel argued that if a district map meets the three prongs of this test, then it creates an entrenchment of power defined as, quote, making a political party, and therefore the state government, impervious to the interests of citizens affiliated with other political parties. In addition to this test, the panel also used the relatively new method of measuring the efficiency gap, first developed by law professor Nicholas Stephanopoulos and political scientist Eric McGee. The efficiency gap test measures and compares the number of, quote, wasted votes for each political party across the states. These are votes cast for a political party in a district that is guaranteed to be won by the other party. it was determined that a 7% efficiency gap would have allowed Republicans to retain their seats under the new Wisconsin map. The panel found that the gap was 13% for the 2012 election and 10% for the 2014 election, well beyond the minimum needed of 7%. By combining these two tests, the panel determined that the new district map was unconstitutional and ruled that Wisconsin needed to redraw its district maps by November 1st of 2017. Following this ruling, the state appealed to the Supreme Court and was granted their request to put a hold on redrawing the districts. What's most intriguing about this case is the fact that it may supply exactly what has eluded the court for so long, a reasonable standard for adjudicating claims of unconstitutional gerrymandering. The test, which was sought for by the court in Veith v. Jubilerer, may be a variation of the district court's proposal. Though some experts agree that this case does provide a reasonably clear standard, it remains to be seen if the Supreme Court will be amenable to relatively new and untested metrics like the efficiency gap. The court tends to be split along ideological lines, mainly conservative and liberal. Out of the nine justices, there tends to be a 4-4 split. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Stephen Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan consistently leading liberal, John Roberts, Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and newly appointed Neil Gorsuch leaning conservative, with Justice Anthony Kennedy providing the swing vote depending on the issue at hand. So far, the liberal justices have expressed concern over the consequences of not intervening. The efficiency with which parties can now gerrymander their districts is frightening. If reasonable limitations are not put in place now, what is to stop any state legislature from ensuring the majority party stays in power perpetually? On the conservative side, Justice John Roberts is concerned that setting the precedent of determining voting districts could taint the court and start a flood of challenges to district maps across the country. What needs to be noted here is the fact that the justice most likely to provide the deciding vote, Anthony Kennedy, is the justice who sought after a reasonable standard in his concurrence in Veith v. Jubilerer. It is possible that the test introduced by the district court could satisfy Kennedy enough to influence his vote. If so, we could see a decision with far-reaching effects on elections throughout the country. With another gerrymandering case, Benisek v. Lamone, already in front of the court, and others brewing in Pennsylvania and South Carolina, the Supreme Court may finally be forced to assume a more active role in assuring a fair and open voting process in the United States.
Finally today, we take a look at some of the developing stories that you should be paying attention to this week.
As a follow-up to our story we covered last week, it looks like Mike Pompeo was set to be confirmed as Secretary of State this week. And how did that happen? Well, Rand Paul flipped his vote in the committee, and also he's going to on the Senate floor, which I was shocked by, to be honest. I guess he met with Pompeo and Trump, and he was assured that Pompeo shares Trump's more moderate foreign policy ideas and is not going to pursue interventionist policies. I guess I have to take back what I said last week about Rand Paul always voting on his principles, because I don't see any evidence that Pompeo is going to change his ways and he's going to have any less of a hawkish influence on Trump once he's confirmed. Also, there was a Republican who was out at a funeral, Representative Johnny Isaacson. And so in order to get the vote actually done, one Democrat voted present who was going to vote against, so he canceled out the affirmative vote. And with Rand Paul switching, he was pushed through the committee with an 11-9 vote. And this is what you're going to have to pay attention to this week. Once it gets to the Senate floor, assuming Rand Paul will vote for Pompeo in the Senate, Heidi Heitkamp, another red state Democrat from North Dakota, has come out and said that she will vote for Pompeo, meaning that he has the votes, he has the majority in the Senate, and barring some drastic change, he will be confirmed as Secretary of State this week.
Over in the UK, on the 3rd of May, England will have its local elections. Now, while this in itself isn't actually incredibly important, it is the first electoral contest in the United Kingdom since the disastrous general election held on June 8th last year, which saw the Conservatives play for a bigger majority only to lose the majority that they did have, with the results ending in a hung parliament. Since then, Prime Minister Theresa May's approval ratings have sunk to a level only known by the opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn, and so the local elections being a second-order election, voters tend to do all kinds of crazy things, often to send a message to those in power, and the complexities of English local government mean that not all of England will actually be voting next week. But it does provide a litmus test for the feel of the country in the midst of all the Brexit uncertainty that's going on and the popularity of both Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn.
Switching gears to Asia, the 2018 Inter-Korean Summit is set to take place today. This will feature the South Korean President Moon Jae-in and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. The topic of this summit is going to be denuclearization. The summit was put together rather rapidly, and you're seeing some quirky things happening, actually. If you know about the demilitarized zone in Korea, South Korea plays K-pop, just blasts it really, really loud all hours of the day across the North Korean border. And in advance of the summit, they've stopped that, which must be an excellent reprieve for the poor North Korean soldiers who are on the border. But what will not feature in this summit, because it's been put together so quickly, is human rights violations in North Korea. This summit is important because it will give us a glimpse at what you might be able to expect with the talks that are supposed to go on between the United States' Trump and, we assuming, Mike Pompeo over denuclearization. So we could get some hints as to what Kim Jong-un is willing to give up in exchange for what from South Korea in the upcoming summit between the U.S. and North Korea.
Heading back to Europe, on March 4th, Italy held a general election. Almost 2 months later, there's still no government. Parties are still in coalition talks, and most proposals, in fact all proposals, have fallen flat. At the centre of the problem is the Five Star Movement. It's a Eurosceptic, anti-establishment, populist, but largely left-leaning party, although they're quite hard to place accurately on the left-right scale. The Democratic Party, which is the former ruling party and lefty social democrats themselves, had ruled out working with the Five Star Movement in government. This week they've announced a reversal in that position. The Democrats have indicated that they're now willing to enter talks with the Five Stars, only if the latter cut off ties with the far-right parties that they've been dialoguing with. Now, I can't say that problems will be resolved this week, but a populist party like the Five Stars attempting to form government is a fascinating evolution in the populist movement in Europe, and it's well worth a watch.
As my last story today, let's look at the Arizona special election. This happened on Tuesday night, and it was for the 8th Congressional District seat in Arizona. The seat was vacated in December of 2017 when Representative Trent Franks resigned over sexual harassment accusations. Surprise, surprise. Debbie Lesko, the Republican, won the seat, which is not surprising. This district is pretty traditionally Republican, and they also voted for Trump by a margin of 21 points. They voted for Trump 58% to 37% in the 2016 presidential election. What is surprising about this result is that Lesko only beat her challenger, Haral Turpinini, by 6 points. So we're talking about a district who voted for Trump by 21 points to have that margin for the GOP whittled all the way down to 6 points in only a year and a half. This could be potentially significant for the 2018 midterms. If a heavily Republican district can be this close, then you might see a lot of Republican seats with more closely contested races in the 2016 elections flipping to Democrats, which would have very negative effects for the Republican Party and President Trump's agenda going forward. So if current trends continue, we could potentially have a lame duck president in Donald Trump for the last 2 years.
And finally, we come to Armenia. Now, this is a developing story. After 10 years in power, Armenian leader Serzh Sarkisyan has resigned from office after mass protests. Sarkisyan has been a pseudo-dictator in the model of Turkey's Recep Erdogan and an ally of Russia's Vladimir Putin. And after a handy 2015 constitutional referendum, which effectively switched the powers of the president and the prime minister, it was feared that Sarkisyan would simply step down into the new office of power, which handily enough comes without term limits. Now, after months of minor protests, a mass protest broke out on April 22nd, when Sarkisyan was declared the next prime minister. 232 protesters were detained, including opposition lawmakers. The next day, when elements of the Armenian armed forces joined protesters, Sarkisyan announced his resignation, but here's the continuing problem. Sarkisyan's party, the Republican Party, are still in power, so the question is how much reform is actually coming. K Can Armenia make use of the current opportunity to democratize, or do Republicans block reform for their own advantage? Now, this is well worth a look. And with that, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Absurdistanis. We are also on YouTube as Absurdistan with an exclamation point. Be sure to check out our website, absurdistanis.com. That's absurdistanis.com. We post all episodes to this website, and we also host forums for discussion so that you, as the audience, can engage with our content. Thank you for listening, and as always, stay weird.